The question I get asked most by coaches is, how do I find clients? It's the wrong question. How do I become relevant in what I do in my business so I can work with the people I really want to work with? That's the question. The coaching industry has expanded exponentially over the last 20 years. It is one of the top five growth industries. But what hasn't grown is the industry response to business models. In the last 5 years, if you take the global conferences, I can pretty much count on the fingers of one hand the amount of sessions there are about the business of coaching. In the last year in the UK, there were none in any of the UK conferences. This is changing, but we have a responsibility as coaches to respond to that. I think coaching is an incredible community. We want to be the best we can be. We invest in ourselves, grounded, getting our shit together, making sure we're sorted out so we're not projecting stuff onto clients, learning the best skills, getting keen on somatics, mindfulness, whatever it happens to be. Yet it's really hard to do that stuff if you don't have a stable business model. So our intention here today, with me and my fantastic friends and colleagues, is to put the discussion on the table. We don't have big speeches for you. This is the reason I've asked you to scooch forward, is because this is an interactive discussion. In a moment, I'm going to ask you why you're here. What are the questions that you want answered? Coaching is a process. It is not an end game. When you go to plumbing school, they teach you how to put pipes together. They teach you perhaps how to do underfloor heating, but they teach you all the basics. You then go on to specialise, maybe listed buildings, maybe modern properties, maybe something architecturally amazing, but you choose. Because we're not a government-regulated industry, we can design anything we want, and people do. Just when you think, oh God, no one would pay me for that, you find somebody doing it, I ain't getting paid for it. So we're focusing on business here today. I'm going to kick off in a minute. I've got a question for each of the panellists to answer. We've put a bit of an unexpurgated bio on your chairs with ideas about what you might ask each panellist questions about. So we're going to hear from each of the panellists, and then I'm going to say to you, why are you here? If you've got a burning question, I really suggest you shout it out, because we won't have anything else to talk about, because we're here to answer your questions. I'm not going to introduce them and their business model. It's on the Coaching at Work bios, and it's on the bios you've got on your chair. If anyone hasn't got one, I've got some spares here. Maggie, there's someone there who hasn't. Thank you very much. Okay, so, Bex, I'm going to start with you.
Oh. There's always one.
In Bex's bio, I'm now going to read, I don't know if you remember writing this, she said, without her heart really being growing her own business, she started looking for more associate work and approached Talking Talent. I'm really curious to know how you knew that your heart wasn't in it. What were the sort of
signs?
It just felt wrong for a long time, or?
Well, it's funny, you know, my background before coaching was in marketing. I started out life working for L'Oreal doing consumer brand marketing. And so I always had this kind of gremlin hanging over my head of, but you're a marketeer, for God's sake. You know, you should be able to build your own business and get work. And I did, you know, I did do that to a point. But I didn't go into coaching because I had family. It was a few years before I had children that I started my coaching business, but I did have three children subsequently. And for me, it's about having a whole life, and it needed to fit. And at that stage anyway, maybe later it'll be different. You know, maybe I do come back to it at some point, who knows, down the line. But for me at that point, it just felt like time and time again, really, do I want to be growing my own thing? And I had all of these messages of, you're good enough to, you really can, you should be able to, come on, Bex, you know you, we see you, you're amazing, you can do all this stuff. And the truth was that actually what I was more enjoying was being connected with others. So for me, I did have 12 years having my own business, which was called Move Mountains, and I did find and do my own coaching work through that. But for a really lovely chunk of time, I had quite an established piece of associate coaching work through Aspire. I recognise Lindsay in the audience. We did some work together there, which is lovely. And for me, at that time, that combo was great. And since then, it was really in looking for more associate work, actually, that I came to find Talking Talent, who I now work for. And I am actually an employed salaried coach. And I didn't think that existed. And I didn't go out looking for that. And I'll say perhaps more about that later.
Okay.
But I think it's about being honest with where you're at in that moment in your life as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Blair, can you talk to us about a key moment where you pivoted your business? What happened and what you did?
Yeah. Well, this is, I was not sure if I was going to mention this, but the question that Ginny was going to ask me was, how does it feel to nearly go out of business? Is that the first question you're going to ask me? So we reframed it. It's basically the same question, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the point is about pivoting your business is you do it for a number of reasons. You either do it a bit like you because you feel drawn towards changing something, or it's a sort of an away from motivation because what you have been doing has not been working and the universe is basically telling you no one wants this anymore. They might want it, but they don't want you to be doing it. So the biggest pivot was probably about 6 years ago when I went from slightly being... So as you'll know, if you read or scan the bio, I've had lots of different business models with my coaching business. From being a sole trader to employing coaches to kind of everything in between. But it always kind of involved me positioning myself as the same as the other people on the team. So, well, you could work with me, but you could also work with Ginny, or you could work with Zoe, or you could, you know, we'll find the right coach for you was the kind of attitude. And I think the biggest pivot was saying, actually, I'm going to present myself as unique. And what that might mean is that it's a choice of working with me or no one in our organisation, because I'm going to be special. And that doesn't mean better than anyone else, but I'm really going to niche myself and have a personality, a brand, a perspective, a point of view, and then I'm going to go out and tell the world about that point of view. And in a way, that's quite unusual for a coach, because we're all taught, certainly at coach school, you know, you've got to be neutral and you don't bring your stuff. And I decided I'm going to bring my stuff. And that was quite a big pivot.
Thank you. So hopefully you're brewing some questions out there. One more question for Manjula is, you're developing your niche. It's very specific. And I know you came to it in not necessarily a completely direct way. Can you say a little bit more about it?
Mm-hmm. So back in the 80s, when girls of my background, Asian, living very traditionally, didn't have careers. So my sister, who's 10 years older, finished school at 16 with just a few GCSEs, worked in a factory for 2 years, and gave her salary to my dad, and that paid for her wedding. So I stayed with her last night, and it's really unusual to see, you know, the two of us and how far apart we are. 10 years makes a huge difference. So I decided to make some choices, and I left home, and I became independent, and all of that has developed my uniqueness. The exterior does not reflect the interior, I would say. And so I went alone. Independence started there for me, and then employment was great, but I was at a point where redundancy loomed, and I saw it as an opportunity to be truly independent. And my coaching business has gone, as you'll hear, I'm sure, later, from a self-employed sole trader who was primarily dependent on the associate model to growing that, growing my own client base. And as life has changed, so has that. And I am now, I suppose, I've gone full circle. I've totally accepted that uniqueness. And now I applied yesterday, actually, for a coaching contract with Oxfam on a project that is totally about BAMEs, Black and Minority Ethnic Ladies, who are trying to do the same. I thought, well, actually, you know, while I might be getting involved in positive action kind of campaigns addressing diversity or lack of it in organisations, the messenger is me as a BAME myself. And actually, rather than think I'm getting a ticket through the back door because of my background, I'm using it in a positive way, accepting that as part of my uniqueness and that I can add value in that way. Thank you very much.
Okay. What sort of questions do you have? What have you got?
Just to say, I'm Julie. I've been working internally as a career coach within a city law firm for the last 12 years, and I'm just about to start out with my own...
Just about to start out my own coaching practice. Mm-hmm. From a position of complete ignorance, could somebody explain a little bit more about the associate model and how you...
Oh, really?
How you begin...
Sorry.
Oh, good. Ginny loves talking about that.
Okay. I'll just make one or two points about it. But my core business is working with senior executives and leadership circles inside positive side organisations. But the associate model is basically, I'm an associate for Blair and she's sometimes an associate for me, in that Blair might win a leadership development programme inside an organisation. If you were still doing that, yes, you're inside an organisation. And then she needs a team of coaches to deliver that. So she'll go to her trusted pool. It's bloody hard work to get these contracts. I did a piece of work with her last year. We had such a laugh. We went to Barcelona. We went a day early. We hung out with an amazing client. I took my money. Thank you very much. My margins were huge. She'd been talking to the client for 5 years, you know. So her margins like this. Mine are like this. However, she owns the client. She can grow the client. She can do things with the client. And she calls in the right people when she needs them. So that is the associate model. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yes.
So to become an associate, you approach people and say, this is who I am, this is what I do, can we meet? How would you start?
Well, do you want to talk to that? Because I know you've done associate work and you've done associate work. And do you want to say a little bit about that?
You got something immediate?
Yeah, so yes, I've been an associate. I think, listening to Ginny just there, I think if you were the sort of proverbial alien from outer space landing, you'd think, oh, fantastic, I'll go and get associate work then. Because, well, that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? You don't have to go out and get the business yourself. You get generally paid fairly decently for it. So, you know, all of the benefit, none of the sweat, yeah? And I think that that is the attractiveness of it. I think a little bit, I always remember before, I think I was even in the middle of my core coaching training right back at the start, and a friend did a back of the fag packet calculation. She was like, well, you need 10 clients, I think at the time it was 250 quid a month, and then you just throw in a couple of days and they're going to be at like $2,000, and I mean, you're laughing. It's easy, yeah? And honestly, I thought, wow, that's fantastic. I mean, I will easily equal my corporate salary, quite like that, it's fabulous. And then, of course, you get into it, and the catch is, and there isn't a silver bullet, of course, as I guess we all have experienced. The catches are that if you're getting your own clients, well, that can be pretty challenging, just getting those just 10, or however many, at least at the start. And associate work, of course, the catch is finding that associate work, because the truth is that there are not so many people around who are doing that. I mean, how I have found it, and my biggest thing is network, network, network. So it's all about, it's stuff like this. It's meeting people. It's, if I have, the people who I have been associates for, yeah, have all been people, for me, as it happened, who I trained with CTI, Coaches Training Institute. As it happened, we had all done that training. So there was a kind of trust and a bond. So I'm not saying that's the only route, but there is something about put it out there as well. You know, let people know that you want associate work. Sniff around a bit. You know, I guess even Coaching at Work magazine, is, you know, you see the names of certain organisations that are coming up, and it might be, you know, that might give some pointers as to who to approach. But I would say it doesn't necessarily grow on trees. But, and Ginny's a great person to speak to.
Well, I would say. The thing is, I've heard some horror stories from associate partners, people who've got the business of coaches turning up and just opening their diaries and saying, you know, you've accepted me as associate, please can I now have some work? And actually, your associate partner, the person who's won the business, they need a story. They need your identity. Manjula, I think you, from the way she just spoke, you'll have got exactly what she's about. So if she was your associate, you would be in with a client and they'd be talking about diversity and you'd go, OK, I've got to bring Manjula in. You would just know it straight away. And you would feel proud to be able to do that and you would know you were offering something different. So associate partners are facing out towards the industry, getting business in. It's a tight, tight market. Yeah. Associates have to manage themselves and their relationship with the associate partner. So it's a much bigger deal than I think has previously been thought about.
Thank you.
And can I just, excuse me, make an analogy? It's a little like having a 0 hours contract. So, you know, you can get on the books and have that relationship, but you have to manage that relationship and get in their face and make sure they don't forget you, because just your being on the books doesn't mean that you are going to get the work. So you need to get in touch with that contact who allocates the work regularly and appreciate the downsides of a 0 hours contract as well.
It's basically treating your associate partner as a client. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's exactly, yeah.
That's exactly what I was going to say. So I, for the last 12, 13, 14 years, I have had a team sitting behind me, and I get phone calls quite frequently and emails from people who want to be associates and want to join my team. And, you know, they really, if they're not going to treat me and my organisation like their number one client, then why am I going to give work that I could be doing or that other people I trust could be doing to them? So, in fact, just as you say, it can look like, oh, brilliant, I sit and the phone just rings and I fill my diary. Actually, you have to work those relationships just the same as if you were going direct to the client.
Thank you. Okay, yes.
Can I just say, I do lots of associate work and love it reasons you say. I think what I've learned, there have been a couple of bad relationships. It's often my values and my associate partner's values have not been aligned. And interestingly, I don't do any associate work with them anymore. And the relationship was originally born out of friendship and working together in the past. So I think there's important, if you are being an associate, that you have some alignment and congruence with where your provider is coming from. I think that's really, really important to have a happy and successful relationship.
Definitely. Thank you.
I just want to add something. So, as I mentioned, now I'm in an employed capacity, which I think is pretty rare. I don't know that many opportunities for that. But from a business model point of view, Talking Talent has consciously chosen to go down the route of employing in-house coaches. So we have about 30, slightly more than 30 employed people within our business, of which about a third are coaches. And for us, from a pure business model point of view, you get to a tipping point. And actually, if you're structuring it in a way that you're employing people and you're having their chargeability, i.e. the amount of hours that they're working, being sufficiently high, then actually for the business, that's a better model, because you're no longer paying out people on a day rate or on a, you know, whether it's a different associates have different models, I guess, whether it's a 50-50 split of the coaching fee or some percentage that you would be taking home yourself versus the business that you're working for. So I don't know if anybody in this room is running or is potentially thinking of running a model in the future where you would yourself actually employ people. But I think it's a really interesting option, actually. It's absolutely not for everybody. But we hear a lot about associateships. I suppose the big difference is the commitment factor. You know, clearly, if you're employing somebody, that's a big deal. That's somebody's livelihood. There's a commitment there. You can't just walk out on them, can you?
I do remember coming back. You'll see in my book, I was employed for about 9 months, and I just didn't last. I was utterly useless. And I thought it was time to be a grown-up. So when I got offered a job, I went, all right. And I've come back from 2 days of facilitation, and on the Wednesday, I had to go into the office, and I phoned up my co-facilitator at about 1 o'clock. I said, what are you doing? She said, I'm in the bath. I said, oh, God, are you? I've had to go into work. And when you've been facilitating intensely for 2 days and you've been away, you kind of need a day down. So for me, it was, I was so jealous, I could barely speak as I was doing some spreadsheet or something. But I think it's really important to know what it is that you like. And up to a few years ago, being employed was really a minimal option. I spoke at Worcester University the other day, and quite a few people came up and said, we're interested in coaching as a career path. How do we get into these organisations? Oh, I had no idea, but they asked the question. Thank you. Who else? What burning question you got? Why are you here? Make sure you get what you're interested in answered. Yes.
So I have a question for Blair, and it's around how you get to be a world authority on something, and what you believe.
Is that what it says in my bio?
Yeah.
You tell it. You write it in your bio. That's really what you do. That is basically what you do. I mean, to be honest, if you pick a topic where not very many people know very much about it, and you are the one who's doing the research and having the conversations, you end up being a world authority. So in my area, I'm particularly interested in what is the future of leadership? What kind of leaders do we need now and in future, given all the changes that are going on in the world, and in particular the changes that are happening in business? So I make it my business to understand what are those changes, what does work and what does business look like in future, and then what kind of leaders are we going to need to run or to be part of those businesses. And there aren't that many people doing that work. So when I'm represented by quite a lot of the Speaker Bureau in the UK, there isn't anyone else in the Speaker Bureau giving that keynote. And so that's why it felt quite credible to do it. But some of it, no one votes you a world authority. And I think one of the things that I was thinking when you were asking your question, but I think it goes for probably everyone in the room, is that if you want to be in demand, then... So I remember when we were training as coaches a long, long time ago, and there was this idea that, well, once you can coach anyone, which is sort of true, because you could apply your coaching skill. You don't need to have the expertise in anything except for coaching. But that sort of attitude isn't going to win you any business. It's too broad. And so the narrower you can be, the more specialist you can become, and then you become the person that is associated with that thing. And all right, there's 99.9% of the business over here no one will ever ask you to do, because it's not yours, and you could do it, and you could earn money doing it, but then you've got this 0.1%, 0.2% of the business that you own, and you're the only person who does it, or you're in a very small clutch of people. And I would really encourage all of you to think about, well, what's mine, what do I care about? If I want to see a change in the world, what's the change I want to see? What would I read? I mean, I used to say that Harvard Business Review was my porn. You know, I would read it late at night in bed.
You
devil. I know, because I love that. And if you feel that strongly about it, then you can make it your specialism.
Can I ask you to talk a little bit about how you built your keynote up, because you went from zero agents and zero keynote to creating something that didn't exist before. So can you just do a couple of how-to steps?
Yeah. I mean, do people like speaking? Is there anyone here who likes speaking or would like to turn speaking more into what you do? Okay, good. I mean, it's a combination of things. So firstly, it is literally a process. So you do things like you get some free speaking gigs and you get someone to film you doing them and you put a showreel together. And I think a high-quality showreel is really important, because I think it tells the story that you do this for a living and you had some money to spend on your showreel. So I think showreel and the kind of collateral, how much are you going to charge, what is the name of your speech. I had a name for the speech and a kind of bullets even before I had the speech. I actually wrote the speech when I had my first gig coming up, because I just wasn't motivated to do all the detail until I knew that. But still, I had basically the thing, right? The package and the collateral. And then when I had all of that, I went to all the Speaker Bureau websites and I had a look at what they already had, who they already had, how they were all laid out on the pages, their bios, and I created individual bios for each of the bureau. And I happened to have an introduction. So I had been in business previously with a keynote speaker, And so I was able to use his name to open doors, but that's all it was. It was, I used to be in business with so-and-so. Oh, yeah, 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 how is he? Oh, yeah, good. Now it's all me, right? And then it was, this is what I'm doing. This is my expertise. Well, you would need a showreel and a bio. Great, have all that. I'll send it to you immediately after this call. So that was step one. Out of probably in this country, there are 20, 25 bureaus, something like that. I'm represented by about 10, and I'd say about 5 or 6 of them are very proactive in getting me speaking work.
How long did it take from, oh, I think I'm going to be a speaker, to paid gigs?
In the first year, I had one.
Okay, that many?
But it was in Turkey. It was cool. And it went well, and people laughed in the right places, and I was like, oh, good, I hope that was funny. It was funny, so that was good. That gave me confidence. But so one in the first year, 2 or 3 in the second year. Now I'm probably speaking once, twice a month.
I think the time thing is important, because certainly on the associate program, when I talk about taking 2 or 3 years to build really credible, strong, sustainable coaching relationships, people sort of go in horror. And certainly I am guilty for thinking the phone's going to ring and there's going to be a 10 grand piece of business at the end of it. It happens occasionally, but really not often enough to get a mortgage. Question at the back there. Stripy dress lady, did you just put your hand up? Yes.
I noticed, though, that creating a niche often involves
writing lots of books or writing books. Mm. And that's really not my thing. So,
not my thing either.
No, I noticed that you have that in your bio.
Yes,
that you
but I hate it.
I hear that from all authors, actually, that they hate it. But I know that I really would. I'm not suited.
Jules has got a niche. I have a niche, and we don't. But do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. I suppose I haven't written a book, and the only kind of book I'm thinking about writing is a how-to practical kind of reflective journal, so it won't involve very much writing on my part. But I have written a few articles on LinkedIn, and through not necessarily speaking as a keynote speaker, but training, facilitation. So my niche is diversity, but it's in an even more narrow area. As an independent lay member who assessed lawyers, solicitors, barristers who are seeking judicial appointment, I no longer sit in that area, but I know how the process works because I'm a business psychologist as well and design and run assessment centres. So from that came expertise in what the judiciary are looking for. And from that, I developed a positive action session for the Law Society, and I have been running those courses very, again, exclusive, I suppose. Only 10 people, make it really interactive. And that has grown over the last 4 or 5 years. So I probably see 100 people, 10 each time. I have an opportunity to present to them and have, hopefully, a positive impact. And they come back to me when they're interested in a judicial appointment. So the other bit of speaking I do is via webinars. So I do that as a marketing strategy. So every other webinar I will have as a freebie, and every other I will charge and spend a lot more time on the ones that I charge on. And I record them. And then I don't have to be there to, you know, if somebody said, I missed your webinar, I'll say, well, you can buy it for this much, or I can also, I'm thinking currently about a subscription. So I will have a suite of webinars that people, whether they make it or not, they can have this recording for free. So you don't have to speak. It's just one-to-many strategy kind of thing. And
that's
flows
helpful
out.
Because that's more where I was going with my thoughts in terms of having a presence online and but maybe not having to write the books.
And you have greater reach.
Yes.
You know, you can go global.
Yes.
Books
thank
are
you.
Very passé.
Well, I was going to say, Sam Collins, who I worked with at Aspire for a while, she wrote a book, and she didn't write it. She said it. I know that she used some people, and she shared this story. It's very, she's very open about it. She got some people to video, to film her, not to be showing the filming, but then they transcripted it. So there are different ways of producing a book than writing a book. And I think it's back to strengths, isn't it? Well, I guess we all love working to our strengths in this room and know where you're drawn to.
Mm. Thank you. Okay. Who's next? A lady in the grey T-shirt at the back, and then...
Thank you. I'm really interested in building on that previous question, actually, the kind of resources that you might use or the tools and ideas that help you build your business. You know, it's 21st century business of online presence and LinkedIn profiles and all of that kind of thing. What sort of things are emerging for you that you're finding really helpful? And it might be the stuff that you might have moved on from that you're happy to share in the room. I understand the leading edge might not be the space that you're happy to share, but what helps you in your work and your presence and your profile?
Shall I answer this one?
Yes. Yes.
The most important thing is what we've already talked on, which is the community. Mm-hmm. So your coach community, because I talk about process, marketing, business models, everything is the most important thing that I've done. I think 98% of my business has come through my connections with other coaches. But in terms of the models, I do the Profitable Associate, which is an online model. It took me about 2 years to work out how to do it. I wouldn't say it's flying out the door. I still haven't got the website right. I'm not entirely sure I want to get brilliant at online marketing. I'm realising it's a whole specialisation itself. I've got a very good friend in the States who's a genius at it, and every time she talks to me, I feel like an idiot. Mm-hmm. And she goes, oh, and I go, oh, of course. But it's very attractive to me to develop something I feel passionate about, but to have it be something that I can wake up in the morning and it's sold. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just is coming in. So I think that that's something that lots of coaches are interested in, but it's... To be honest, when I thought of the idea, I thought I would just kind of chuck it up and then it would sell. I don't know why I thought that. It's taken nearly 3 years to get to this point. It's a lot of research. And the other tools would be, I use a lot of podcasts to stimulate my thinking. So and also having very human, honest relationships with clients about what is the experience they want to be having inside their organisations.
Do you have any... Chad.
Yeah, I can. So in Talking Talent now, we have a head of marketing. So once, I guess for a business, this is our sort of scale right now. One of the things I'm really enjoying is that there are actually people who are particularly focused on doing just that. So that person in our case is not a coach. She's got a huge sensitivity for it, but there's that person who's dedicated to that. In my previous existence, what's helped me, I think lots of things. I mean, there's loads of tools out there. I did a great course, which I would really recommend to people. A friend of mine, Corinna Gordon-Barnes, whose website is youinspireme.co.uk. And she does this course, which is now available just online, which is called Passion to Profit. And I found that really helpful. I did that some years back for my own business. And it's really practically taking you through what do you need to turn it from just being a nice passion into a profitable business. Then there's all the kind of internet outsourcing. Again, one thing I've really learned actually from being self-employed and frankly being a bit of a hobbyist for quite a long time and coming into Talking Talent, which is really run like it is a proper business. Gosh, it's a proper business. How terribly astonishing! But you know, we are. We're 3 million business. We're fast heading towards our 5 million target. We're a strong, healthy, fast growing business, and we need to actually all be behaving and acting accordingly. But I think you know, it's one thing being in that context, but still, we're a small business. Really. So, you know, we have to outsource sensibly. We use a PR agency. We use web designers, you know, all the sort of things that are, yes, we might have a different, slightly different budget for it, but we don't have a huge, huge budget for all that stuff. We still have to be very smart about it. But I think that mentality of, and it's a really personal thing, you know, you need to decide, are you serious about this? Are you in business? Or are you actually quite happy with it being something, your coaching work being something that just kind of ticks along and it makes you happy and you don't necessarily earn stacks from it, but that's okay. And I think that is really okay. But if you want a business mindset, let's face it, coaching is not something that you need huge infrastructure investment to set up, unlike other businesses. If you're going to a retail business, or my husband sells stuff on Amazon, or, you know, you have to buy stock. Whereas for us, there's not usually something that you have to cough up front. And I think we need to be more prepared to do that. Yeah. Whether that's using a virtual assistant to help you, whether that's outsourcing some stuff, using, I mean, there's great websites. 99 Designs is fabulous for if you want logos and collateral and materials created. And it's all quite reasonable, but you have to put a bit of loot in order to get the payback. I think it, as a coach, it's easy to fall into that trap of, well, I have no overhead, so I'm not really going to spend. But certainly one of the things I think that has made Talking Talent successful is we have invested in order to get return.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm talking to my friend in the States about using her team to do my online stuff, because I can see, I keep thinking I'm going to get to it, and I'm just not getting to it. Yes. And I think that this point about the business is really important. There are people per hour, I get a lot of translation services from them, or transcription services. They're really good, whether you put up your job and people bid for your business. But I think the key point about investing in it, whatever it happens to be, I went to the States 3-4 years ago, invested an eye-watering amount of money in an American coach because I just was a bit bored. And business was okay, but it was just all a bit boring. And I went to the States and worked with a different coach in a different environment. Has anyone read Steve Chandler's The Prosperous Coach? Anyway, they was that sort of type of coach. It was extremely uncomfortable, but I learned about lots of different types of ways of doing business, particularly higher value coaching. So when I talked to another coach about this on one of the ICF webinars, she ran me after and she slightly accused me of lying about fees and stuff. And I said, why would you say this? And she said, well, I don't know anyone who charges those sorts of fees. And I said, well, respectfully, I think you're probably in the wrong goldfish bowl if it's of interest. And she has now not done exactly the same things as me, but she started to expand the environment she's in. It's always to hang out with coaches doing a bit better than you, I think, is a key tool. All the coaches I know are much more successful than me, much better and clever and proper coaches than me. And I hang out with them, and that, I think that's a really key tool. But also, if you're not finding what you need, go out and look for it. And there's a lot of really great stuff coming out of America. Rich Litvin, Steve Chandler, Ron Wilder, there's lots of people doing stuff. I can certainly give you more names.
And can I just add that however fearful you are of technology, just suck it up because you're going to have to harness it. So
come Zoom.
If you can't afford to, GoToMeeting is what I've subscribed to. I got a good deal one Christmas when somebody's end of year sale target could be met if they reduced it. So I've stuck with it. And, you know, so you can profile it with your own logo. And also, I invested quite early on, quite a reasonable sum for me at the time, in a platform for psychometrics because that's a niche part of my business. And so whilst OPP could offer MBTI at this price, I can offer what's called the JTI, the Jung type indicator, which is what MBTI stemmed from, for a much cheaper price. It's just not called MBTI. So I've got 15 PF instead of the 16 PF. So there are lots of other alternatives, and I can brand it with my own label. Zero for managing your finances. I think the important thing is that consistency in service. And if you don't get your systems sorted, you're always going to be this sole trader business who doesn't have that professionalism in front of your clients.
I never, ever, ever do appointments with my clients. I work for some quite big corporates, and some of their appointments is a nightmare. And I'm not going to reduce my credibility and my status by being the one who talks to the PA. And also, I'm not very good at it, so I make mistakes, especially with time zones. And sometimes, you know, if business is really quiet, she's probably made £50 a month, and other months it's £1,500. So having a VA, I got my VA about 6 years ago when I was really upsetting one of my clients because I was supposed to fill in one of their systems, and I hated doing it. I don't like detail, and I thought they were probably going to fire me over an admin thing. So I quickly got her on board, and she just sorted everything out. I've never met her. And she swears by and her webcam doesn't work, so I'm just not sure what's going on. Thank you. Your question.
I guess it's a variation of the theme, really. and that's about website. Because every time I think I'm going to, it's not the financial commitment, it's the time commitment to really think about that. I've only had a couple of situations where people have really wanted to check my website or asked about it. Usually the conversation and the one-to-one works from there. So I've been happy on Twitter, happy on LinkedIn, and I think I know the answer.
Yeah, shall we just move on? Yeah.
Well, no, can I just step back from that? Because I think that it's a bit like Ginny said at the beginning, it's the wrong question. So when you end up with a website, a really good one, it's the thinking that's gone into creating it where the real value is. Because I've pivoted and I've changed my company name a couple of times and, you know, my business has evolved, I've done this process quite a few times. You always end up crying quite a lot of the time. It's very, very painful. It takes a lot longer than you expect and it's much more expensive than the quote. But what you end up with if you have done this and you have taken it seriously is you end up really, really clear about what work you do, who you do that work for, how you're going to talk about it, why they would want it, where the value is for them. And so your website, writing the copy for the website is the very last, the photography or whatever, it's the very last thing. And in a way, it's only one of the ways that you'll use all of that. Mm. All of that work. I agree with you. Hardly anyone goes to my website and then talks to me, but I sometimes direct them there to go and have a look at something. Or if you want to know more about me, go to my website. If you want to read my latest, if you want to listen to my podcast, it's all there on the website. So it becomes this place where by accident people go to find one thing and then they read some other stuff. But fundamentally it was all of that thinking first, and I personally wouldn't cut corners with it. I wouldn't throw tons of money at a branding agency that's charging you what they charge a corporate. Wouldn't do that. But if you can get a way of doing that thinking, that's really important.
Yeah, I think you're right. The bit that I was shaking my head at is that I now always go and look at people's websites. 5 years ago, I never used to. So if I'm talking to you, I will go and look at your website. We will look at your LinkedIn, and I think people do that. And again, like you, I veer away from redesigns or redrafts or rethinks. But actually you can repurpose. There's a lady called Callan Rush, and she talks about repurposing. So you do that once, then you can repurpose it into a keynote, you can repurpose it into a talk, you can repurpose it into a workshop. So actually, when I think about just doing it for my website, my heart sinks. When I think about it as a broader business clarification and know that I'll be able to use that in many different ways, suddenly it becomes a bit more interesting. Thank you.
You also need to think about what you want to use it for. You know, is it that online checkout factor so that they can just check your creds? In which case, it can probably be pretty simple. I did something, so when I had my own business, I was self-employed. In fact, it was for an event that Jennifer in the audience here was running a couple of years back. And I didn't have a website in the run-up to this particular event. And it was a month. And I had about 6 weeks. I was like, oh, shit, you know, I'm going to be going to this really great event, meeting lots of people. I've always meant to have a website, and I never have. Anyway, in short, I did a website. In fact, I wrote an ebook, did a website, did a whole load of repositioning stuff, wrote some articles in 4 weeks flat. And I never thought that I could have, but I kind of got the fire. So I think the other thing related, I think the undercurrent of the website is always, oh, God, it's going to take ages and it's this really huge thing, and it doesn't necessarily have to be.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Your question.
Hello again. Blair, you said about your speaking, which I'm terribly impressed by, keynote speaking. And do you find that you get an awful lot of your business following on from that? I'm just wondering what sort of audiences you're presenting to.
No, I don't.
Oh.
So this is really interesting to me, because one of the big motivations for doing the speaking was I'm going to be addressing the leaders in the room, and then they're all going to come up to me after and say, can you help our organisation, because we love what you said. And they come up and they say, oh, we loved what you said, thank you. And then they go away. And I think a couple of reasons for that. One is they've already paid me to come and speak. So I'm not there to try to win more business. It's very distasteful to do that. So I wouldn't kind of do any marketing from the stage. So what I'm doing is I'm sharing a thing that is self-contained, and then they say, thank you, that was really inspiring, and they're done. So that's part of the reason why. The other reason why is that up until quite recently, when I noticed this, in fact, my accountant said, so what are we thinking about this keynote speaking? Is it delivering, this is his way of saying, you're wasting your time. Is it delivering what, it's income generating, so it's okay on its own. But then I started thinking about it, and I thought, actually, I just need to be more proactive. So there are some things that I've started doing in the run-up to the event. I always get a really thorough briefing. But now I spend quite a lot of time with them in person in the run-up as well, if I can. We talk about what they're doing to continue momentum from the event, what else they've got going on. I offer a lot of time afterwards. Would you like me to come in? I will have spent the whole day at the conference. I can come in after and share with you some of the insights I got from talking to your people over the day. I'm just going to do that. That's a value add. So I'm building a relationship. And one of the things we said earlier when we were talking about associate work is that it's a similar thing, that I might do a speech for a company now and they might need me in 5 years' time. And if I've lost touch with them and I've thought, oh, well, I did the speech and I don't care about them anymore, they won't call me in 5 years. But if I've stayed in touch, if I've been adding value, if I've been pointing them towards other resources that they'll find useful, not necessarily me, giving my time, then, as happened a couple of weeks ago, I'll get a call out of the blue. Hello, my name's... You won't remember me, but we worked together 5 years ago. Oh, yeah. Now I'm the CEO of a company with 50 million turnover and we need some help. So I think you have to play the long game, but I was surprised myself that people weren't queuing up to say, oh, come and run our offsite next week. They weren't.
Thank you. So it was sort of really sowing the seeds for future relationships. So
yeah, broadening the network. You're always broadening the network and then looking after that network. Some people stick, some people don't. You can't look after everyone, but definitely that's the way I see it now.
There's a big drive in coaching business community for being of service. And it's a tough line to walk between being of service and being of service to manipulate them to like you and get to give business. So there'll be some people you do connect with and some people that you don't. And Blair and I have worked a lot inside companies, and sometimes I'll really hit it off with perhaps a CEO, but actually she gets on really well with somebody else in the business, the L&D person or CFO, whatever happens to be, and we just sort of naturally cleave into those relationships, not pushing, not force, but also thinking about them. What's going on for them right now? There's a meaning conference in November, which I'm a big fan of. I've told all my clients about it. I've told all, it's alternative leadership, leadership with social conscience. It's in Brighton, it's totally brilliant, you have to come. And Blair spoke there last year. And I use that, I'm really passionate about the people involved in that. And I invite people that I'm not working with, but then of course that also brands me a bit because I'm doing something a bit different. One of my clients, who I just agreed a really massive contract with yesterday, is the global head of L&D. I was doing a project for their company. I hadn't spoken to him for 9 months. I've now been moved on to somebody else. But there was a lecture on the RSA of Utopian for Realists. And I rang him up and went, this is going on. I think you might be interested. And he went, God, I would be really interested. And we went. I totally meant to talk business, completely forgot. and it was fascinating. So it doesn't have to be just coaching or leadership things or stuff they're interested. It can be treating them as the whole person as well. So in terms of your service and your interest in them. There's these sober morning raves called Morning Gloryville. There's one next week in Bethnal Green. One of my clients is coming with me to that. I mean, you know, it just depends how you pitch, how you work your relationship with them. I'm pretty familiar with my clients, as I imagine you're getting the picture. So I see them as a full person, they see me as a full person. I haven't invited all of them to that, weirdly. Not everyone wants to talk a unicorn at 6 o'clock in the morning. But you know,
I want to know about this event, I think.
Well. It's really fantastic. Yes, top five best experience. Right, we've only got a few minutes left. Anyone got a burning question? They just don't want to leave the room without... Yes.
Interesting to hear you talk about decide, of really refining your niche and deciding who do you want to work with and what kind of work do you want to do. And I'm interested in that because I'm just in the process of actually writing an article on that for BACP Coaching on finding your niche. So I just wondered if the panel in general have any more kind of tips or ideas for identifying your niche. If you're just a generalist and you really have no idea about where you do want to specialise, where do you start with that? I don't know who wants to answer that. Anyone?
Yeah. Who wants to go first? Do you want to
go first? I'll go first. I think... I work a lot in career coaching, and I think it starts with your own self-awareness about your strengths, because I think we sometimes get a little distracted by what we're good at without simultaneously being mindful about what we enjoy as well. Because we can get good at lots of things because we're operating in a particular area that involves lots of repetition, so we get even better at it. And then people start coming to us to ask us to do this because we get known for being good at it. And we might get paid even better, and that continuously reinforces our impression of what our calling is. So I would say get that self-awareness about what you actually enjoy and are brilliant at. And, of course, I would say this, psychometrics can help, and it can be one source, but feedback, soliciting feedback is not very British, especially as coaches where you're working independently. You have to ask for it because you're not going to get it in an appraisal because no one's doing your appraisal. Your clients are doing an appraisal in terms of whether they hire you again or not. So keep in touch with, you know, that feedback and solicit that to really get some data on what your niche should be, where it's steering you. And don't pressure yourself. It's evolving. Yeah. I'm still learning. It's fine-tuning as you're on that journey.
I'd say my business is deeply autobiographical, yeah. is what I'm interested in at the time. I pivoted a few years ago away from leadership. Away from leadership development programs. And actually with this organization I did this contract with yesterday, I've actually refused to do any more one-to-one coaching in that organization. As I'm not doing a lot of it at the moment. It's not where my energy is, and actually I don't think it's right for them. And the group thing, I think, is where it's at, and that's what I'm pioneering. So I tend to go where my interest lies. I've got 3 A-levels, driving license and MCC, and that is it on the qualifications front. I don't have any psychometric training. I don't have any. Yes, I've done various different coach trainings, but I'm very much on this panel, I'd say, more of the back of the sort of envelope, and I go with what I'm interested in because that's where my energy is. There was a piece of research done in Kansas, and I'm sure you've heard this before, that the power of the coach or the model they're using depends on the passion and the belief they have in it. Mm. That's why it's hard to deliver other people's materials. So spending time with yourself and knowing yourself, as Manjula says, and thinking, well, what am I interested in? If I won the lottery tomorrow, what would I do if I was still coaching? Just got a couple of minutes. Do you want to?
Well, I just want just one more thing. To me, it's not even about the niche. It's about the niche. I think that's where we're going, because the fact is, I mean, I did my initial training 14 years ago, and it was all really new, wasn't it? But now it really is. Just here today, there's lots of us. And it is that thing of how do you stand out? So I firmly believe that even though lots of us have a massively allergic reaction to the notion of a niche and narrowing down and everything, I think back to the question, how do you identify? I think you start broad. You know, when I started, I definitely coached anyone going, frankly. And I think that's great, because then you get more of a sense. And then for me, my specialism developed actually through my associate work, because I happened to piggyback into another company that was focused on women's leadership development. Thought, oh, I really like this. And then grew that myself. And with Talking Talent, our niche really is within women's leadership development, and specifically within a focus around managing the transition to parenthood. So we do maternity and paternity coaching support. And we're not the only ones to do that, of course. But that is, it's a particular area. And I think the closer and the more targeted that you can get the better.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. We need to stop there. We're around, certainly until lunchtime, some of us, and everybody's very open to any questions that you want to have answered, or certainly if there's you think of a question on the way home, we're all very happy to be emailed, or if you need a resource, or you're just left with, I need a bit more on that answer. They don't quite get it all. Thank you all very much, ladies. Excellent.
Thank you.